Support for the following program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional funding comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. The American Prophet, a discussion about Joseph Smith and the beginnings of Mormonism, this week on Soundings. Join me now for a conversation with Richard Bushman of Columbia University.
What I mean is that when other religions took shape during the Protestant Reformation, they usually originated in a interpretation of biblical passages, so that it's a set of ideas about salvation or God. In the case of Mormonism, it's the story. It's the story of Joseph Smith. It's the story of the Book of Mormon. It's things that happen. And Mormons really root their belief and their faith in these events.
Historian Richard Bushman. The early part of the 19th century in America was a time of religious ferment, especially in upstate New York, where Joseph Smith established the Mormon Church in the spring of 1830. He did this on the basis of several astonishing claims. He declared himself the object of angelic visitations, the instrument by which pure Christianity would be restored to the earth after centuries of apostasy, and the translator of a book that made the extraordinary claim that Christ visited ancient America after his resurrection. Richard Bushman is the author of Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism, published by the University of Illinois Press. I asked Richard Bushman to describe the task that he set for himself in writing a secular account of the early years of Joseph Smith, whose life and work from the outset have been the subject of controversy and divided opinion.
Well, it's a problem that I had to face as a writer myself. I'm a believing Mormon, and I certainly don't want to say anything that implies that the events which occurred to Joseph Smith were fabricated. On the other hand, I'm very conscious that people who are not Mormons want to explain why in the world did this person believe that these things had occurred to him. Mm. Was he a liar? Was he self-deceived? And I think all historians face that problem. Do you take him at his face value, or do you enter with deep doubt and question the whole thing from the very roots?
You know, you make me think, Dick Bushman, of William James in his account of religious experience. He says that we can look for truth, but it isn't necessarily productive to look for truth with a capital T. Rather, we should look at the way a religion works and how it functions in the culture. I take it that you came to it, as you say, believing in Joseph Smith, but also seeking to attempt the workings of Mormonism in the 19th century.
Historians who are sympathetic to Mormonism, I think, take that Jamesian perspective. Look what the Mormons accomplished, and they are magnificent achievements. But for Mormons themselves, the Jamesian perspective simply won't do.
Yeah, that's irrelevant.
You don't base your life on something that may be true, but is just a hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. What's the objective of the book? What are you trying to accomplish in writing about the beginnings of Mormonism?
Well, I truly wanted to write not just for Mormons. I wanted to write for a broad general audience, and yet I had to write as someone who essentially believed the story. And so one of my first objectives was to make clear that I was trying to explain this total movement as it was experienced by the people themselves.
Uh-huh.
And whether or not you believe that what they believed was right, at least you could get inside their minds, not just Joseph Smith's, but his family and his circle of friends and the people that came to believe in him.
How did you work your way through the evidence, Dick Bushman? I mean, on the one hand, we've got mainly the testimony, and that's an important word in explaining Mormonism, of believers, of people who were sympathetic to Joseph Smith. On the other hand, you have violently critical reactions to Joseph Smith. How did you balance the act in that regard?
Virtually every source on early Mormonism is tainted. it's either sweetened or soured by the perspective of the people who were writing it. Because Joseph Smith so quickly became a controversial figure, immediately. And so there's virtually no source, even written at the very time, that isn't taking one side or another.
Did you feel any pressure from the church itself, the modern-day Mormon church, I mean, which controls a vast number of these documents? What was the interplay between you as a historian, you as a Mormon, and you and the writing of history?
Well, I had access to everything. So far as I know, there's nothing that I was not allowed to see. And no one said a word to me about how I was to treat the works. So if there were any tensions or strains, they were strictly internal. There was nothing institutional that troubled me.
Let's talk about Joseph Smith and, we can put a lot of 50-cent terms here on the table, Dick Bushman. Theology, history with a capital H, the social history of America in the 19th century. What I want you to do is to explain Mormonism, put it into the context of other religious forces that occurred at the time that it came into being. Is it really that different?
Well, there is a yes and no answer to that. One of the sections of the Doctrine and Covenants, the 20th section, which was written at the time the church was first organized in 1830, sounds very much like a conventional Christian creed. I mean, people deny that Mormonism is Christian religion, but that, I think, is simply foolish. It is a deeply Christian religion and does not attempt to make any vast departures from standard Christian theology.
Let me stop you for a moment. What I'm thinking of is that I've heard it said that Mormonism is unusual or unique in mainline Protestant Christianity because it denies the doctrine of the fall of man, quote-unquote. It denies original sin. Now, is that important theologically? Is it important historically in your account of Mormonism, or is that kind of nitpicking that doesn't really make any difference?
It's important in this sense. In this era, Calvinism is under attack. This is the moment when the wonderful one-horse shay is about to collapse. And it's has immense strength still in the evangelical religions of that time and continuing to today. But the evangelical pressure for a conversion experience, which many people could not manage, meant that there were lots of people who were looking for alternate forms of salvation.
We're talking about rationalism here. We're talking about the weight of what you might, just this large word, the Enlightenment.
Yeah, you could say that this is sort of a mild form. And Joseph Smith and Mormonism are among those who opt out of the strict Calvinist view. But they're in pretty good company. I mean, the disciples of Christ, the Church of Christ, are opting out at the same time, all the followers of Alexander Campbell. So in that sense, it's not it's not alone. Where I think Mormonism stands apart from the others is that it is on the boundary between traditional views of the world that could be called magical or superstitious, where there are spirits and powers and invisible forces all around us, things that were commonplace in New England in 17th century, but were fading among educated people in the 19th century.
Well, they've hardly faded even in the 20th. You just go to the grocery store and look at the headlines on the National Enquirer, and the world is still filled with invisible spirits that apparently a lot of people believe in.
These things never die. There was an effort by the educated classes to crush them in ordinary people, and they couldn't. And Mormonism is right on the boundary of that, because the fact that there's an angel appeared, that there's a buried gold plates in the hill, touches on all of these old superstitious views at a time when they're under attack. And Joseph Smith gets caught in that crossfire between magic and the Enlightenment.
Let's talk, Dick Bushman, about some of the specifics that you raise in your book about Joseph Smith and the beginnings of Mormonism. Was he a money digger? Was he a charlatan? Was he a magician? How do we explain Joseph Smith, who was taken so seriously by so many people today, when in his own time he was accused of all of these egregious errors?
It's probably the most difficult part of Joseph Smith to understand, and what I thought when I began would be the toughest problem, because there are people who accuse him and his family of treasure digging. And I finally came to the conclusion, yes, they were treasure diggers.
But there were also other treasure diggers.
But the world was filled with treasure diggers. It was right. By like saying he played poker or they drank whiskey. Things that Mormonism would now itself repudiate. Everybody was doing it. And really Joseph Smith's achievement is to extricate himself from that magical culture that enveloped his very own family. Uh-huh. And turn the finding of these plates into a very serious religious mission.
Let's suspend our disbelief, Dick Bushman. What is the Book of Mormon about? What happens in this account?
Well, it's a fabulous piece of writing. And whatever you say about Joseph Smith, let's say he did it all himself, it's an incredible, creative piece of work.
Is he a translator or is he a creator?
Well, of course, Mormons say he's a translator. And that would be my view. But however you look at him, you've got 520 pages that evoke the history of an entire people, actually two entire peoples, over 1,000 years, their religious life, their political life. A whole world comes into existence in that Book of Mormon.
And your argument would be that this is just impossible for the... How old was he? 20, 22 years old, something like that?
Well, yeah. He's born in 1803, and he gets the plates in 1823.
Uh-huh. So how do we account for this? Is it an act of faith, or is it an either-or kind of thing?
Well, there are all sorts of ways of accounting for it. And efforts have been made to locate the sources of all the Book of Mormon ideas. It's right. Anti-Masonic, it's anti-Catholic, it's Republican, it's this and that. And I would not deny all of these things, but what I would insist on for believer and non-believer alike is that this is a complex book, and you're not going to be able to account for it by simply locating 10 or 12 sources of possible sources of its ideas.
Yeah, was it Mark Twain who said, if we take out all the heretofores and wheretofores and it came to passes, so that's unfair.
I'm ashamed of Mark Twain. He's a better reader than that.
Well, it's supposed to be another witness for Jesus Christ. I mean, that's how the Mormons characterize it, a new world witness for Christ. Do you think, as a historian, as well as a believing Mormon, that that's a fair characterization? How do we nail it down? What do other historians, archaeologists, tell us about the truth or the falsity of the accounts that we have in the Book of Mormon?
Well, as you can imagine, it's a highly contested territory. There is a massive Book of Mormon industry within the church that generates an extensive scholarship, proving to the satisfaction of these people that there are parallels between Book of Mormon rituals and details of warfare and this and that and what goes on in Israelitish countries in Palestine. And I find a lot of this persuasive. There's a much less extensive but nonetheless pointed body of scholarship that says it's fraudulent. There are horses in the Book of Mormon. There are no horses in America after 10,000 B.C. So it goes back and forth, and
is it an act of faith, finally?
Well, I think Mormons themselves would say it's an act of faith. Mm-hmm. That Mormons have a kind of an epistemology where essentially you have to allow the Holy Spirit to guide you. But the guidance just doesn't come in a blinding flash of yes or no, but sort of an illumination of what seems right. And for my own satisfaction, the arguments in its favor just loom stronger, more persuasive, more tensile than the anti-Mormon arguments.
Dick Bushman, tell me about the translation of the Book of Mormon. What was this process like? What went on when this book was being translated?
It used to be years ago that non-Mormons tried to find another author, some other source. They couldn't believe a foreign boy could write it. Nowadays, it's focused on Joseph Smith as creating the Book of Mormon versus Joseph Smith as translating it. And there are many viewpoints. One is that he was indeed under writing under religious inspiration, but not translating anything, and that he would intersperse experiences of his own, experiences of his own culture with this kind of story of the past, which God indeed was feeding into his mind, much the way critics of the Bible think that inspiration was received by Isaiah.
Uh-huh. So what is it, religion by committee? If we look at the New Testament, the Old Testament, and the Book of Mormon, is religion by one man?
All right. I guess that's fairly close to it. The Mormons themselves thought for a while that it was extraordinarily literal, that he looked at a character on a plate and a character would appear in his mind with the English translation, and he would simply read it out of the Urim and Thummim, these glass spectacles that he had. Now I think it's fairly clear that Joseph Smith was not looking at the gold plates as he translated them.
Here you have a powerful testimony for history as narrative. In its quintessential form, the great story being told rather than a lot of an assemblage of technical details.
I think that's right. And the marvel is that he could keep up that narrative flow, say he is just creating it, through 500 pages and not have it just fall apart on him.
Tell me about the testimony underscoring the appearance of the Book of Mormon. I mean, Joseph Smith makes this, to some people, outrageous claim that an angel comes to him and tells him where to find these golden plates. Was he the only one really to have seen them and touch them and therefore be able to talk about them? Who else was there?
It's a question Mormons get all the time. Where are the golden plates today? And they're not around.
They're not in Salt Lake City.
The angel came and got them, as Joseph said.
Uh-huh.
But he did show them. There were 11 other people who saw them, not to mention his wife, who dusted them as they were covered up but sitting on a table. And three of these 11 said that an angel appeared to them, just as he appeared to Joseph, and showed him the plates.
Uh-huh.
So it was not just a single man speaking for God. This revelation that burst upon the world through Joseph burst into the minds of many of other people.
Uh-huh. And what do historians make of this, Dick Bushman? Talk to me in your role as a professional historian and not necessarily a practicing Mormon. Is that enough testimony? Suppose we had an analogous situation. Would a historian look at it and say, well, we got 3, 8, 10, 11 witnesses. That's enough to satisfy me.
It certainly has not satisfied anyone. Who doesn't believe. The criticism is that most of these people were his close friends or his family members, and people figured that somehow or other they were in on the scheme.
Uh-huh.
Either they had been befuddled by him or they were in it for malicious reasons.
Well, the other objective would be money, the making of money. Wasn't that what Joseph Smith was accused of doing?
All treasure diggers are accused of trying to deceive people in order to bilk them.
Uh-huh.
And the Book of Mormon was seen as a money-making scheme.
Do you think it would be fair in the circumstances that created Mormonism to look back on it and say that Joseph Smith was in any way led a life that was parallel to these rather unfortunate people that we have bilking the masses today? I'm thinking of people like Jimmy Swaggart. Was that the way Joseph Smith was looked upon in his time?
Well, there are a lot of psychic gains in being the leader of a great movement, but this guy went through great miseries. He was thrown in jail, he was whipped, eventually he was killed for his belief. I think it'd be very hard to say that he was in it just for the fun of it or some kind of personal gain. He put his life on the line for this religion.
So he continues to be the subject of much interpretation. I remember reading that no less than Harold Bloom, who is not a household name, but he's a very prominent literary critic, has said that here in Joseph Smith we have an American archetype for originality and imagination, for American literature. That's a pretty hefty statement. What do you think about that?
Well, when Bloom gave his talk in Salt Lake City, it created a great sensation, partly because he was so admiring of Joseph Smith. He said he's the most creative religious figure in American history, a bona fide creative genius. That part, I would tend to agree. I think Joseph Smith is immensely creative. Uh-huh. And however you look at it, he turned out a huge body of material. But like so many public figures, Joseph Smith has projected onto him the wishes of the people who study them. And Bloom seems to be making Joseph Smith into a Jewish Gnostic, for which there is some evidence, but I don't think that captures the whole of Joseph Smith, or perhaps not even his essence.
A lot of people in the 20th century associate the name of Joseph Smith with polygamy. Is that a fair charge? I guess that would be one question. And what does polygamy have to do with this book that you've written, Dick Bushman, about Joseph Smith and the beginnings of Mormonism? Is there polygamy in the Book of Mormon, for example?
Well, the Book of Mormon is quite a perplexing on that subject, because there is a passage, a whole chapter, in which polygamy is condemned as a sin because of the unfaithfulness of the people who practiced it. But there is one little escape clause that where the scripture says, if I will command my people, otherwise they will obey these things, which leaves the possibility that maybe under certain circumstances polygamy is possible. And of course we have to acknowledge that the patriarchs in the Old Testament practiced polygamy, so it can't be condemned entirely. Mm-hmm. I don't think Joseph Smith had polygamy in his mind at all in this stage, but fairly early on in his life it arose as a possibility, though not until 1840 did it. In the 1840s was it actually practiced.
What about the issue of race? You know, the Book of Mormon is, after a fashion, it's an account of how American Indians got to be American Indians, mm-hmm. and it says what? There's people who are blessed and cursed, and the ones who are cursed have dark skins. Racism is not too strong a word to use here, is it? What about that?
Well, again, you go on two sides on this thing. It certainly is racist in the sense that the evil people, the Lamanites, are cursed and their skin is darkened. On the other hand, the Book of Mormon is equally explicit that this curse is strictly a function of their wicked traditions, and that when they get themselves straightened out, then the curse will be removed. It isn't something that grows out of their genetic structure, it's their moral structure. And there comes a time in the Book of Mormon where the so-called cursed people are more righteous than the blessed people, and they mingle freely, and the curse absolutely disappears.
Well, here in the 1990s, Mormons have accepted, opened the doors, as it were, to people of color. How do you come to that kind of question?
Well, the prohibition in among the Mormons against giving the priesthood to blacks was a terrible burden that we had to bear for a number of years. And the Mormons were accused of institutional racism, which I suppose was true. But on the other hand, instantaneously, that was totally obliterated in 1978. And you could say the revelation was a result of pressures outside. Mormons would say, no, it was revelation. But the fact that they believed it was revelation was immensely significant, because it meant there was no second reading the prophet's proclamation. Yeah. Everybody had to change at once.
Yeah, the Lord has spoken, and that's it.
And it obliterated racism in a second.
Mm-hmm. Dick Bushman, let's be whimsical for a moment, and particularly in the instance of Joseph Smith, I think you can have some fun with this. Suppose he were here at a third microphone. You've written a book about this man, spent a lot of time thinking about him. Is there one question that you would ask him about? Is there something that you're particularly curious about?
There are two questions. One are the missing historical facts. There's this little puzzle. He claimed to receive the priesthood from heaven. He didn't bother to tell us when he received it.
He was on the run, wasn't that?
He was on the run.
When Peter, James, and John were supposed to have appeared to him?
Exactly. And the church has been flustered by that lack. So I would start there before he disappeared from the scene again. But I think other than that, I would want him to talk to me. I would want him to tell me the story all over again from the start, so I could sort of listen and hear it in his own voice right then and there, and sense what kind of a person he really was.
What's going to happen to the life of Joseph Smith amongst the professional historians and biographers? Your book takes him up to 1831. There have been many other books written about the origins of Mormonism, placing it in political and cultural circumstances.
Every corner of every archive and every attic has been searched for new documents on Joseph Smith. The chances of new ones appearing, I think, are being reduced. When we had this flurry of them in the 1980s, it turned out that all the new documents were forged. Yeah. So it was a great disappointment to us. But that the absence of new evidence will not stop the generation of new perspectives. We just know that a character of these proportions will be reconceived over and over again, not just by non-Mormons, but by Mormons themselves.
Richard Bushman, your book is Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism. You are the Governor Morris Professor of History at Columbia University. Thank you for your participation on Soundings. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
My pleasure, Wayne. Thanks.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to a conversation with Richard Bushman of Columbia University. Richard Bushman's book, Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism, is available from the University of Illinois Press. If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 601. That's program number 601, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes, and when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, the third segment in a series of Soundings programs about the idea of a civil society, that space between the individual and the state that accounts for much recent political and cultural transition around the globe. I'll talk with Robert Darnton of Princeton University and with Connor Cruz O'Brien, the Irish diplomat and writer. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.
Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Richard Bushman of Columbia University talks about his book, Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism, which narrates Smith's astonishing claims, including heavenly visitations and the translation of a book that records a visit by the resurrected Christ to ancient America. Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.